BCFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with political economist Ponny Winch and Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. We look back at some untold stories of 2011 and some favourite internet films, plus forward to the ominous year of 2012. With the announcement that the formula for a deadly form of flu could be published online by a Dutch lab, we look at the changing face of modern warfare and at the latest US hypersonic weapon which can hit anywhere in the world in half an hour. Armed satellites designed to knock out other satellites, can war be fought for our hearts and minds, that is, using TV, social networking and the now massive industry of public relations? Plus the Armageddon scenario being contemplated in the Treasury. What could they be planning? But first, an announcement of the 10th annual New Year's Eve peace vigil at Imber Army Training Village in Salisbury Plain in Wiltshire, and at the isolated Church of St Giles on Saturday the 31st of December. That's tomorrow from midday. This is a peace vigil with a difference right in the middle of Salisbury Plain, the Army training area. We're being asked to please bring along poetry, readings or music on the theme of peace. Wrap up warm and bring strong footwear. There's no heating, loos or other facilities, so please bring whatever you need to take good care of yourselves for a couple of hours. The car parking is in the abandoned village. The village was requisitioned by the army in the Second World War with the promise that it was going to be returned to the villagers at the end of the war, but never was. But there's still one part of the village which is not used by the army at all, and that is the church, which has got a kind of fence around it. And you're also asked not to stray away from the paths if you decide to go there, because a bomb may explode and kill you. So do be careful if you're going to that peace vigil that you stay to the paths. Roads, I mean, you don't have to go to that particular event, but it's good to remind people that roads through to Imber from Gore Cross, Warminster, Bratton and Heytesbury, this is over in Salisbury Plain, are opened from Saturday the 17th of December and remain accessible until 8 a.m. on Tuesday the 3rd of January 2012. So if you've never had a drive around the Imber range on Salisbury Plain, you can do so between those dates, Saturday the 17th of December and Tuesday the 3rd of January. And we're told by the organiser, Ruth Underwood, whose family came from that village, best wishes for a happy Christmas and a peaceful new year. And so that starts at midday tomorrow at the village, abandoned village of Imber in the middle of Salisbury Plain. But to start our second hour, we're going to have a look at actually pick up on an interview which I did last year with a monetary reformer called Bill Still. Now, Bill wrote a book all about monetary reform, and I just wonder, before we start that, Polly, you first, how important you think monetary reform is, because it does seem to me that the current leadership of the European people, they just keep meeting and meeting and meeting. They're not really getting anywhere. It seems to me as if there needs to be a root and branch rethink about the way that money works in order to get it to serve the population, the public, rather than to serve the bankers.
Definitely. I think there needs, I agree with you, root and branch reform. Like I said last week, I think money needs to be tied to something tangible, so we don't have this ridiculous phenomenon of, you know, money just creating billions of pounds in a few seconds through some sort of algorithm on a computer. And I think also that kind of like people need to have more power over where their money gets invested. So at the moment, you've got a lot of people's savings or their pensions going to an investment fund who then decides where to invest it. And I think it needs to be brought much more directly back to the people. I mean, even perhaps the situation where you could go online and you could choose, actually, I don't want to invest my money in this arms company. I don't want to invest it in this corporation. I'd like to invest it in this different company, and kind of bring the power back to the people about where their money goes.
But the thing is, you won't make so much money that way, will you? If you give it to somebody who's an insider in the city, they're going to surely make much more money out of your investment than if you were to try and play that game yourself.
I'm not sure that that's true, though. I think it's kind of, you know, as consumers, you know, there's only a very, very few people, and there's loads, sorry, at the top, and there's absolutely loads of us. So, I mean, if we all started to decided that we're going to start buying fair trade or whatever it is that we believe in, I think, you know, those industries would boom and the other industries would crumble. And the same, you know, goes for kind of defence and weapons and stuff. If we all, you know, take charge and say, actually, we don't want to have these wars, then they won't make any money.
The trouble is, of course, with all these austerity measures, our power as consumers is going down and down and down. It's diminishing, isn't it? Because we've got less disposable income all the time.
And clever of them, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we do need monetary reform, and no doubt we're going to have a conversation about that in a minute. But I'd also like to raise another issue. In Sweden in the 1980s and early 90s, Rudolf Meidner, who's a Swedish economist, put forward a proposal for what he called wage earner funds. And basically, this would be a tax on employers and employees at 1%, and then the money would be used to buy out Swedish industry on behalf of the workforce. And this was, they had a social democrat government, and they'd redistributed wealth through progressive income tax and payments of welfare, and they decided, right, well, what the next step is for all of Swedish industry to end up being owned by Swedish workers. And the way you do it is you just have a 1% tax on payrolls, and then you gradually build up a fund. And he said we could have a 1% tax and we would own all of Swedish industry in 25 years, or we could have a 2% tax and own it all in 13 years or whatever. And of course, the Swedish employers went bonkers, because basically said, we were going to buy you out, but we don't have to worry, we'll keep you on as managers. But of course, they weren't happy with that, because of course, capitalism is actually a dynamic system. You can actually generate enough funds to buy out the industries if you want to. And they made such a fuss that the whole thing was shot down in flames, and then the Conservatives won the election, and it never happened. But these are the kind of things that we might be thinking about, eh? What about us all owning our own industry?
Well, when I spoke to Bill Still, I started by asking him about this crazy dilemma where banks can just make up money out of nowhere and then lend it out of interest. Literally, make up money. It's a kind of monopoly thing, really. Well, you can make up money, but I can't, but you can, out of nowhere.
It's a great gig if you can get it. If you or I actually lent money at interest that we didn't have, I believe that's called counterfeiting or fraud or both, and we'd be immediately thrown into jail. But when you're a banker and you can do it, you can get away with it. And, of course, it's in the banker's interest to try to keep the politicians from making that a crime. And that's exactly what they've been able to successfully do. So we have a two-pronged problem. That is, we have nations borrowing money. That's a problem that has to be fixed. And we have banks lending money that they don't actually have. If you fixed those two problems, then you fix the economic system, and nothing else will fix the economic system. Until we address those problems, this is going to go nowhere but down, I can assure you.
Now, if you go back a thousand years, the only kinds of money that were around were gold, and then over the years, the bankers, goldsmiths, started to use pieces of paper to represent the gold, because paper was more convenient, it wasn't really heavy. They were keeping the people's deposits in gold, but then they could trade that gold using those bits of paper. How did the bankers then start issuing actually more bits of paper than they had gold in their coffers?
They just did it. It was a fraud. The temptation is way too great. If you have a gold repository and you're issuing pieces of paper to represent the gold, it's way too easy, especially if you're loaning out these pieces of paper and getting interest back. It's way too easy to overissue pieces of paper because it's in your financial interest to do it. And the problem was that back in 1100 AD, King Henry, the son of William the Conqueror, was the first one to actually do something about this scam. And he decided that the goldsmiths, by either lending out their pieces of paper liberally or refusing to lend them out, could affect the entire national economy. They could cause booms, boom times, good times, by lending out liberally, throwing more money into the economy, or they could cause depressions by contracting that money supply. And the problem with it was that thereby they controlled the politics of the nation. They could go into the king and say, look, we don't like this policy that you're doing. If you continue, we're going to cause a depression. Because they had discovered that the goldsmiths never got the blame for the depression. They could always push the blame off on the sovereign or the politician. And so thereby they controlled the politics of the nation. So that's why King Henry invented tally sticks, which was basically the form of money upon which the British Empire was built for some 700 years. And that broke the back of the goldsmiths, put more money into the hands of the common person, and took it away, the money power, away from the bankers. And this is what led to the empowering of the middle class that brought on the whole rise of the arts, etc. in Britain. And it was a good thing.
What is a tally stick?
A tally stick was basically just a stick of hazelwood that was polished and split down the middle. Notches were cut into the stick before it was split, and then when it was split, you had two halves that were identical, that when they were put back together, it was impossible to counterfeit, in other words, and the king kept one half and spent the other half into the economy, paid for things. And how do you pay for things with a stick?
Yeah, good question. How do you?
Well, it's very simple. You declare the tally stick to be good for the payment of taxes. And so there's a built-in demand for the tally stick. Well, we've got to get some of those tally sticks because that's the only thing we can pay our taxes with. And so it circulated as money. And it was money without debt created strictly by the government for the benefit of all people equally in the public interest. That's what money should be. That's the most important thing that should be in the public interest, the issuance of money.
That was Bill Still there talking to me about, actually I interviewed him about his film called The Secret of Oz, which is one of those films. I don't know if you two saw The Wizard of Oz over Christmas, did you? But you know, you're watching that after you've seen The Secret of Oz, it makes you realise that actually the whole thing of The Wizard of Oz was written as an allegory. For example, what he says in the film is that the ruby slippers were actually the one thing that was changed between the original Wizard of Oz book and the film. And in the original book, the ruby slippers were silver slippers, or silver shoes, actually, weren't they, that Dorothy is wearing as she's going up. And the yellow brick road is the gold brick road. So the gold brick road is the gold standard, which is a little bit of a dangerous thing to go along. But if you've got your silver as an alternative form of money represented by the silver slippers, then you're fine. That's how Dorothy manages to get along. The other thing is that the scarecrow was representing the agricultural workers, the tin man is representing the industrial workers, and the lion represents some guy called William Jennings Bryan, who apparently was a monetary reformer back in the early part of the 1900s. Polly, what about for you, for what he's saying there? Is essentially that, look, if you allow private businesses to issue money, they basically end up totally controlling your politics. And he goes on to say, I didn't use that clip, but he also goes on to say your media too.
Well, I mean, that would be all very well if I didn't think that our politics, making money something that the government issues, essentially, and taking that power away from the bank. I mean, can you trust the government? I mean, it doesn't really matter to me whether it's private or public. It's about the intentions of the people that are doing it.
Well, at least you get a chance to vote in a government, don't you? There is some kind of checks and balances with the public voting for people who are populating the treasury. Martin, what are your thoughts on that?
I think there is a problem with governmental power. I think it would be better if money were issued in the public interest, as Bill is suggesting there. But then how do you define the public interest, and how do you enforce that? And basically, the government is only as democratic as the system that creates the government. And there's always a room for abuse. But I can't see any case, really, for allowing the power to create money to private sector institutions.
So how has it ended up like that? I mean, is he right in saying that this is just lobbying from the private interest?
Basically, they've lobbied for what they wanted, and they've got it. And then, of course, the governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, has suggested that we might have to look at things like fractional reserve banking and monetary reform. My main critique of monetary reformers is that they sometimes come across as if it's a silver bullet, and that if we just reformed the money system, everything would be right. I think you would still have some problems to deal with, even if you could reform the monetary system. I actually believe that you need to have government investment in the economy as well. It's not just enough to reform the system of money creation. You've actually got to have a government that wants to actually have a plan, basically.
What he's saying there was, I mean, he was talking about this medieval system, the tally stick system, which I found fascinating. The idea that you actually, all you need is a bit of a stick of wood, you split it down the middle, and you spend that stick as money into the economy. And the only reason that it actually circulates as money is because you can use that stick to pay your taxes. So it kind of says that money could almost be anything. Polly, what do you I mean, you know, okay, so at the moment there are certain people who are allowed to the banks basically who are allowed to trade money and use it on their, put it on their computers, etc., and they're trusted that they're not just making up numbers, but this idea of going back to, I mean, I just want to float this with both of you, could we go back to some form of tally stick system where it's actually the government that's saying this is good for the payment of taxes? Then surely we may have another kind of cultural renaissance like he was talking about there, where the money starts serving the people. This seems to me the fundamental problem is at the moment that the people are having to serve the money system rather than the money system serving the people.
Well, I'm not sure about a stick, but I think what that highlights is the fact that money is, you know, need, I know I've just said that it should be backed by something tangible, but on a kind of separate issue, I mean, money is sort of the oil that just basically liquidates exchange, which is something that as human beings we naturally do. And I think it's important to think about the power of credit, because we hear talking about, you know, the banks just make up this money and they lend it to people and that creates debt. But really, we've got these credit rating agencies. I'm not talking about the big ones that kind of rate the governments and corporations, but I mean there's other ones that rate us individually. So my credit rating, for example, is absolutely horrendous and I would never be able to get a mortgage, well, not for the foreseeable future. And I mean that's actually a huge amount of power. It's very disciplinary. If you know, you have these kind of these are private institutions that if you don't behave in a certain way with your money and you don't do this, I mean they track pretty much everything. They can have the power to deny or, on the other hand, to grant credit to people, yeah, or to deny it. I mean, I think that no one really seems to talk about that.
I think that's right. I mean, basically, the money system is used as a means of disciplining people. So, for example, the level of strikes in Britain has gone down dramatically as home ownership has increased, because people cannot afford to go on strike. Because they can't pay the mortgage.
Now, I could guarantee you that if I was to go to one of these big banks and say, look, I've got this great idea that may work, but it's a Terminator gene, Terminator technology for crops, where we can sell crops again and again, the seeds again and again to farmers every year, the banks would rub their hands and say, yeah, we'll invest in your industry. But, I mean, if you wanted to open a bookshop, you know, what were the days of the internet, they wouldn't want to invest in that. So they do have quite a lot of power of who they lend money to and who they don't.
Well, that's right. And I think ultimately the money is the basic mechanism of control in a capitalist society. And the Poles have a saying, if you don't know what it's about the money. And ultimately it's a means of asserting power over others.
I think you've raised a really interesting point, Tony, which is that finance needs to be connected with some kind of morality or some sort of sense of ethics, you know. And I think this goes back to what I was talking about earlier, is perhaps we need to think of some kind of mechanism for democratizing it, because at the end of the day, the banks, it's fractional reserve banking, but essentially they're lending the money that we deposit with them. So savings and, you know, it's our money. So really, kind of taking that intermediary role that they play away and just having the direct kind of connection between I want to save this money, I want to invest this money, and I want to invest it in this specific thing because I believe that is a good business.
I mean, we had a story, for example, a couple of months ago about Barclays investing in the cluster bomb industry, even though the Britain and various other countries have signed up to an anti-cluster bomb treaty, yet it still seems that they can kind of go and invest in these illegal weapons firms because it looks like they're going to make some money. Anyway, that was just really one film, internet film, which hasn't been shown on television. It was called The Secret of Oz, and that actually I think is about an hour. What is it? No, it's 2 hours long, and you can watch that online if you just go to YouTube and put in The Secret of Oz, and maybe Mr. Bill Still. His Secret of Oz website looks like it's down at the moment, but there you can watch that for nothing and find out some of the hidden meaning in L. Ron Bound's original book, The Wizard of Oz. And next time you see The Wizard of Oz, you'll see it in an entirely different light. There are also quite a lot of films on the internet. I'd like to run through a few now, which give a fascinating insight. And, you know, I kick myself sometimes thinking, well, goodness me, why can't they show this on the television? One of them is a film called Ludicrous Diversion, which was made way back in 2006. I mean, it's ramped up hundreds of thousands of viewings online, but still hasn't been shown on TV. Martin, you've seen the Ludicrous Diversion film. What's it about?
It's basically about the London bombings of 2005, and of course we were also involved in the making of the film Mind the Gap, which is about on a similar topic. Basically it's questioning the government's story about what happened on the day.
The other thing, of course, is it looks into this whole vision idea of the new types of public inquiries, one of which, moving swiftly on, is looking at the Leveson inquiry. So it seems that we've got a different type of public inquiry. In the old days it was a proper judicial inquiry where certain witnesses would be subpoenaed, if you can do that in Britain, that's a US word, but basically they could force people to come and testify. And a big inquiry we've had this year is the Leveson inquiry into press ethics. Now that started out as a criminal investigation, Polly, into phone hacking of Millie Dowler's phone by the News of the World, and in an operation which certainly appears to have been masterminded by David Cameron's head of communications, who resigned last year, Andy Coulson. And that was a criminal act, and yet still we had a few arrests. What are your thoughts about these new types of inquiries we're seeing now, Polly?
I think they're absolutely rubbish. I mean, if you watch them on TV, the strangeness of the situation really is startling, because you see these MPs, right? No offence to them, but they're not lawyers. I mean, they don't really know what they're doing, asking questions of these, you know, these sort of witnesses or the people that they're interested in. And I mean, what the people that they're asking the questions of are saying is literally called evidence in the write-up. You know, like, this is the evidence. I mean, in a proper criminal court, that's not evidence, that's just what someone says. I mean, you could say anything you like. And I think, you know, really one of the main problems that we've got at the moment is the fact that we do not have the equal application of law. And so, you know, if I commit a crime, or you commit a crime, or Martin commits a crime, we have to go to court and then we might go to prison. And the fact that you've got a whole layer of society that it just is immune from that is really, really dangerous.
I think that's right. I think also, I mean, the Pat Finucane Centre in Northern Ireland have been pushing for inquiries into various things that have happened during the Troubles over there, but they are pushing for international inquiry. They don't want an inquiry run by the British government, because they say that the British government's inquiries basically are whitewashes.
So can you just tell us, who was Pat Finucane?
Pat Finucane was a lawyer who is basically a senior criminal lawyer. He represented quite a lot of terrorist suspects, mostly Republicans, but some loyalists.
But then the word went around the security forces, didn't it, that he was actually in the IRA?
His brothers were, so that was the presumption. But he was assassinated in front of his family, and it's believed by the family that it was actually orchestrated by the Royal Ulster Constabulary. And they've been pushing for an inquiry into this.
Well, David Cameron apparently promised them an inquiry, and now has backtracked.
Yeah, well, in any case, they won't accept an inquiry run by the British government. What they're calling for is an international inquiry, with a different set of evidentiary rules and so on. I mean, basically, inquiries in Britain are a way of kicking things into the long grass.
Well, they certainly have become that way.
I mean, the Hutton inquiry, for example, into what went on with the David Kelly affair was completely farcical, and we still haven't had a coroner's inquest to determine whether he committed suicide or not. They presumed he'd committed suicide, and then had a whole inquiry based around the idea that he'd committed suicide.
It's almost like
they assumed that they had to prove.
You know what? It's almost like a kind of trial by television, Polly. Would you agree with that? What we're seeing, for example, with Leveson is a sort of, you know, it's a kind of TV, almost like a TV drama playing out rather than a proper court case.
Yeah, and I feel like they're really just not, it's not acceptable to just take someone's word for it. You know, you actually have to get this evidence. And I mean, all the people that have been arrested, they've been released like a few hours later. I mean, you know, it's nonsense.
Well, hopefully they've been bailed, I would hope. They're not allowed to flee the country. They may have had to give over their passports. But I think, you know, I would agree with you that I don't have a great deal of confidence, as we saw with the Cash for Questions thing with Tony Blair, that that's actually going to be a prosecution eventually, even though the evidence seems to be very clear that something needs to be done. So this whole business of impunity, Can you see anything changing, Martin?
Not immediately, but I would suggest that the reform of the police service in Northern Ireland to become the police service of Northern Ireland has been an example of where, you know, basically a corrupt police force has been reformed. And I think ultimately this is what scares our masters more than anything. The Mani Politi, the Clean Hands Inquiry in Italy, was much more scary for the ruling class in Italy than anything carried out by the Red Brigades or what have you. And I think ultimately, I think that we could get a mass movement around, we want a rule of law for our society.
Well, in a way,
not one law for the rich and one law for
everybody. Well, that's actually
else.
What Barbara Tucker was talking about, you know, from Parliament Square a couple of weeks ago. Exactly what she was saying is that what we need is justice. We need the law to actually be enforced, where at the moment it isn't. And one of the reasons for that might possibly be Freemasonry. What we've got, as promised last week, is an interview that I did a couple of weeks ago with the author Martin Short while I was in London. And Martin used to do a lot of programmes for BBC. He's not been on there for a long time now. I remember doing a fantastic programme about jury service and how juries were sometimes fixed. Certain people were weeded out from juries, which is supposed to be a random selection, and he was showing how in some cases it's not a random selection. But anyway, this is what Martin Short has to say about Freemasons in the police and in the City of London.
I don't give the impression that however many Freemasons there are in this country now, or a good deal less than it used to be, that they're all policemen. In fact, Freemasonry is full of people in many walks of life, and also, by and large, these days dedicated lodges for police officers would not be encouraged, though there is in fact one called the St. James's Lodge in central London, which is entirely staffed by police officers. However, in an average lodge, you might get people from any walk of life, and in among them might be a police officer. Now, it would be a sore temptation, bearing in mind the oaths of mutual defence and support that Freemasons undertake, if you were in trouble, whether it's over a parking ticket or a drunken driving offence or, you know, some punch-up with a neighbour, you know, that you might hope that you could turn to a brother as a Mason in distress, and favours would follow, that maybe bits of paper could be lost and you could avoid prosecution. I think that's a bit more difficult these days, but of course what used to be common practice, you can't be absolutely sure doesn't happen now.
What about the City of London? Because I know back in the 1980s you had a good look at the death of the banker Roberto Calvi. Now, a lot of people now are looking at the City of London and thinking, can we trust the banking fraternities, and can we trust these big investment banks that seem to have such a lot of power over our futures at the moment?
There is absolutely no doubt that Freemasonry used to be extremely strong in the City of London. We obtained a lodge list of all the Lord Mayor's Lodge in London, and universally, one after another, over about 70 years, the Lord Mayors of London were masters of this lodge. In fact, some of them were initiated only after they had become Lord Mayor. Unfortunately, I haven't been blessed by being handed another copy of the Guildhall Lodge members list.
That was Martin Short speaking to me a couple of weeks ago, and his book is called Inside the Brotherhood. It's a sequel to Stephen Knight's book, The Brotherhood, which was published in the 1980s. I think his book, Inside the Brotherhood, was published in 1989, and it's still in print. Both of you, do you think this is a little bit over the top, thinking that there could be some sort of Masonic connection here? Because as we've just heard there, every single member of the guild, every single Lord Mayor of London has had to be a member of this Guildhall Masonic Lodge. And even if they weren't, when they became Lord Mayor, they had to join before they became Lord Mayor.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think there's plenty of people involved in Freemasonry who are perfectly above board, and you know, it's a big organisation, there's thousands and thousands of members. But there's definite evidence, for example, in Italy, the P2 Lodge, and people can look this up by doing a search on their computers, P2, Propaganda Due. It was a lodge at the heart of the establishment in Italy, top financiers, secret policemen, army generals, and they were involved in carrying out acts of terrorism inside Italy in order to achieve certain political effects. And people can check all of these things. This isn't conspiracy theory. This is historical, documented fact. And the fact of the matter is that Freemasonry, the intelligence services, the financial oligarchy, they're all in bed together, and they are engaged in committing and fomenting acts of terrorism against ordinary people. They've been doing it for decades. They're still doing it.
You know, one of the lists of the P2 lodges in Italy, they showed that there were politicians were in there, the police, the chiefs of police for all of the regions of Italy were there, the secret services were in there, and the financial people were all in the same one lodge having these meetings, which were almost like a kind of shadow government. And the most worrying thing about it, in a way, is that there were many of the top press people were also in P2. Yeah. I mean, you know, this was in Italy. Do you think there's any possibility we've got some sort of similar secret government in Britain?
Yes, and don't forget that the secret government in Italy was having its strings pulled from elsewhere, to wit, from London and from Washington. So let's get clear. Basically, the British intelligence services and our financial oligarchs and so on are at the heart of corruption in the world, at the heart of it.
Well, one of the other things which was a big, I found fascinating for 2011, was the release of a film called Unlawful Killing. This was done by Keith Allen, and yet we can't buy it here at all. I tried to buy a copy of the film in the UK. You can't buy it, but you can watch it on YouTube on some of the foreign channels, for example, Press TV. You can watch it in several different parts. Polly, what are your thoughts about this? This is a film about the death of Princess Diana, and yet we're not allowed to watch it here in Britain, even though, I mean, it's been premiered in Ireland, in other countries around Europe, it's been shown in cinemas, but not in Britain.
Well, I think it says a lot. It says a lot about that specific incident, but it also says a lot about, you know, we kind of have this illusion that we, you know, live in a completely free society and that there's freedom of information, and, you know, examples like that show that that really is not the case. I mean, that's something that you would expect from China or something like that. I mean, it's sad.
I think that's right, although I think, you see, it's very difficult now to prevent people finding things out because of the use of the internet, as Ron Paul said earlier.
So what's the point of banning it?
No point at all.
Okay.
Doesn't achieve anything.
Anyway,
really
let's have a listen now to a little extract from Unlawful Killing, and it starts off with the voice of Princess Diana herself.
Well, the enemy was my husband's department. I was a problem. What do we do with her?
This little boy is called Philip. His full name is Philip Schleswig Holstein Sonderberg Glücksberg, and he grew up in Germany. He was raised amongst his Nazi in-laws, some of whom later became high-ranking members of the SS. His Nazi relatives then sent him to this school in southern Germany, where he studied for a while under the Nazi curriculum. Philip later recalled that there was much heel-clicking and shouts of Heil Hitler were compulsory. And here's Philip in Darmstadt, in the heart of Germany, in November 1937, attending a family funeral for some of his Nazi in-laws. Marching in front of a Sieg Heiling crowd, this is Philip, next to Christoph, his SS brother-in-law, and Philip, his Nazi stormtrooper brother-in-law. Imagine if a man with a past like this had somehow ended up marrying into British aristocracy. Well, he did. And as we know, he got first prize. He became the Duke of Edinburgh, also known as Prince Philip, after marrying Princess Elizabeth, the future Queen of England. Philip buried his Nazi past and became a respectable member of British royalty. And his story has continued happily ever after. Apart from a few family troubles that were quickly resolved. In the years before Princess Diana was killed, she told many people that the British establishment was planning to eliminate her.
Oh, of course Diana was bumped off. She knew she was going to be bumped off. But she always said she's not going to make old bones.
Diana had left a note saying that she thought that somebody was going to kill her and that it would be in a car accident.
When a woman left a note saying, FYI, if I'm dead, here's how it's going to happen, and then it happens exactly like that, I think someone should pay attention.
That was an extract from Unlawful Killing, a film by Keith Allen, which is banned here in Britain, but is being seen all around other parts of the world. And if you want to watch it, I'm afraid you have to find someone with the internet and go and watch a review, which is in several parts, which is on the Iranian channel, of all places, Press TV. Now, just on this whole topic, Martin, you said there's no point in them stopping people seeing it, but... do you think that then the internet is... I mean, because the thing is, basically, people have to proactively go out to watch it. They're not going to have it stuck and spoon-fed to them on their cinemas or in the living rooms now.
No, but at the same time, it is accessible. And, of course, we're giving it some publicity on this show. And, of course, Keith Allen is the father of the pop star Lily Allen.
He's done some fantastic songs about the music industry, in fact, yeah. Taking the mickey out of it all, really.
Yeah. But, I mean, of course, it was funded by Mohammed Al-Fayed. And of course our mutual friend Annie Mashall, who used to work for MI5, says that she's fairly convinced that she was bumped off, and it was to do with her campaign against landmines, as you can see at the moment, and also because she was apparently about to take up the cause of the Palestinians as well.
Well, he makes a very good case for that in the film Unlawful Killing about landmines, saying that if it wasn't for this issue, then the French secret services, etc., wouldn't have cooperated with the assassination of Diana. They would have seen this as, so, well, why should we help? But actually, there's a massive French landmine manufacturing industry as well. So this was seen as a potential, sort of mutual interest between the two establishment ruling classes. Okay, so anyway, some other stories from last year. In fact, this goes back even further than that. Barbar Ahmed is a chap who's in jail, and he's been in jail for several years now without charge. This is something that we were hearing about from the US, Martin, but why is it? I mean, it's actually happening in the UK too, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, basically, these people are being held without habeas corpus, so they're not being tried. They're not being charged. They're not being tried. They're just being held incommunicado. And the most interesting person who is being held incommunicado in Britain, to my mind, is Haroon Rashid Aswat, who was named by the Metropolitan Police as the mastermind of July 7th bombings in 2005, and then was immediately disappeared into preventive detention so that nobody could talk to him. I think that basically they were setting him up to be the mastermind, but then basically John Loftus in the US pointed out that there was strong evidence there was actually an MI6 double agent. Now, can you see what the problem is when you've got this preventive detention thing? It means that if somebody becomes awkward or difficult or might spill the beans about something, you just stick them in this preventive detention and nobody can talk to them. So no police officers can interview him to find out what his role was.
Certainly no journalists can.
Yeah, no journalists either. Now, this is the problem. It's not just that it's unfair that people should be put away without trial. It means that the security services then use it as a dustbin for getting rid of inconvenient people who might spill the beans about what they're really up to.
Another story from this year is the announcing of Royal Wooden Basset. Now, Wooden Basset used to be just plain old Wooden Basset, where all the soldiers' bodies came back from Iraq and Afghanistan and these kinds of places. But that's changed, hasn't it? And it's now Wooden Basset has been given the title of Royal, but we're not actually seeing these big processions anymore. Martin, do you think there's an agenda behind that? Because I certainly do. It doesn't seem like there is a high street now where people can come and pay their respects to
I understand that they've started to bring the bodies back to RAF Bryce Norton, I believe. They've moved the place where they unload the bodies, basically. So people in these places are now going to those places instead of to Wooden Basset.
But it's not a proper high street. It's probably
I think the British government was beginning to get bothered about this because it was becoming too frequent. You know, if you've got three coffins a week going down the high street at Wooden Basset, it's just reminding everybody that we're in a war in Afghanistan and we're losing. And the fact, basically, the government decided that this was just too embarrassing.
Another story is the announcement that Filton Airfield will close and the starting of this campaign to save Filton Airfield. One thing I should say is that back in around about 2006, I went down to the Bristol City Council to check through the records of the declarations of interest of all the councillors. And funnily enough, it turns out that the former Conservative City Councillor Jack Lopresti had actually declared in his register of interest that he was a Freemason. And he is the MP for the whole of the Filton area. So he was very nervous, it looked like, on his little declaration that was saying whether he was a Freemason or not. But he actually said there was a little box for a couple of years that people had to fill out, but then the Masons lobbied to have that removed from the declarations of interest. And he said that actually Freemasonry was not a secret society, which I'd just like to put that to both of you now. First of all, Martin, is Freemasonry a secret society? Because Jack Lopresti seems to think it isn't a secret society.
Well, patently it is. Most of it is harmless, but some of it isn't, and it's certainly something that people should know about as an interest. People should have to declare that they are Freemasons, and people need to know what lodges they belong to and so forth, because it matters.
Well, everybody, or just public officials?
Anybody in any public role whatsoever must declare it as an interest. They ought to declare it, basically.
Now, we do talk about Freemasonry quite a bit on here, Polly. Do you think we're being a little bit paranoid about the Freemasons?
Well, I suppose what's important is not whether someone is a Freemason or not, but is what that actually means. You know, so are these people getting together and conspiring, and if so, is that bad, or are they, you know, I mean, there's lots of questions there, really.
Well, I think for me the big question is the oaths that Masons swear when they're initiated into the Masonic Lodge are basically that that they can be killed. They also go through a ceremony where a knife is placed right next to their heart, on a bare chest. It's basically a threat of death if they betray the secrets of Freemasonry, so it's all a little bit weird. I would have thought that this is something that that most definitely has to be declared if someone is going to be any kind of public official.
You might go further and say that nobody who's a Freemason can be a police officer.
I'm sure Jack would jump up and down, and
or an MP.
Or would they
have to resign if they're going to hold a public office? You could pass a law to say that.
Well, could they resign from the lodge?
Well, it's up to them. If they want to be a Freemason, they can be a Freemason, but you can't be an MP or a police officer. It's up to you.
Aren't you saying that they would get killed if they did that?
Well, possibly. I don't know. I mean, the thing is that the threat of death, which is certainly there in these ceremonies, is there apparently if you're giving away the secrets of Freemasonry, or else if you don't defend another Mason in a situation. It says also there's all sorts of stuff in there, but that does sound. I mean, basically, it's really just cult, isn't it?
Sounds a bit creepy, yeah.
I think basically we've got these things need to be properly looked into. At the very minimum, there should be disclosure if people are Freemasons, and you might conclude that it's incompatible with holding public office or public employment.
And it may be that Jack has been made an MP after having been a city councillor, possibly because of his Masonic connections within the lodge, rather than because he's been a particularly good councillor.
Well, most Freemasonry, I'm sure, is fairly boring and routine, but we have definite evidence, for example, of P2 in Italy being used by the establishment as a key secret government type organisation, and I think that that's just not acceptable, and it's got to be exposed wherever it occurs. And just let me clarify, though, I would say also that if Freemasonry didn't exist, something else would. These people always get together. As you pointed out the other week, Adam Smith said business people never get together, even on social occasions, without some kind of conspiracy against the public being cooked up. And that just happens.
Right, well, we're going to talk about somebody that died last year you won't have heard about on the news. Former head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation in Los Angeles, Ted Gunderson. And we'll also be discussing some of the events for the forthcoming year after some music.
Color. is drawing near. Shadows of the evening crawl across the year. You walk across the floor with the flower in your hand, trying to tell me no one understands. Trading your hours for a handful of dimes, gonna make it, baby, in our prime. Get together one more time. 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 Gotta get together. Gotta get together. Gotta get together. Gotta get together. Gotta. Get together. We gotta get it all together. Get the whole thing together, babe. I tell you, we gotta get it all together. One more.
Well, from album Absolutely Live in Concert, that's The Doors there with the lead singer Jim Morrison. From 1969 or 1979, quite sure. But Martin, you've got a little story to tell about Jim Morrison and his untimely end.
Well, it's just there are rumours that Morrison was assassinated, as there are rumours that John Lennon was assassinated because of their forthright political stance against the Vietnam War. Now, of course, we don't know. We've got no definite evidence.
There's certainly some serious questions about Morrison, particularly. His body was moved. This was a story which came out actually about 2009 in the Daily Express, that his body was moved from a nightclub to the place where it was found in the bath. Yeah. But anyway, what do you know?
Well, I mean, the fact was that he was a notorious boozer and he died of a heroin overdose. Now, that's not usual. You know, people who are notorious boozers are not heroin addicts at the same time, because it's just not compatible.
And he had a fascinating thing about Morrison was his father was an admiral in the US Navy.
Yeah, and he always denied that he had a father and said, I don't have no father. But his father was an admiral in the US Navy and the rumour is, again, that he may, again, it's only a rumour, that he was involved in the Gulf of Tonkin incident, where the US Navy faked being attacked by the North Vietnamese to start a war.
There's some pretty strong evidence that he was involved in Gulf of Tonkin, but what was Gulf of Tonkin?
The Gulf of Tonkin incident was where US ships came under attack, supposedly by North Vietnamese patrol boats, but it transpired in the end that this was all a put-up job. There was no attack, they just pretended to be attacked, and that was the basis on which Congress passed the War Powers Resolution, which led to, you know, to the expansion of the Vietnam War. And the fact of the matter is that the US military, and including their British friends, have got an absolutely cast-iron, solid track record of faking events like this. And no doubt something like that might happen around Iran. We know that Dick Cheney suggested to Tony Blair that they could fake some kind of incident. Apparently, there was going to be a fake attack on the Fifth Fleet in Bahrain, but some US military officials scotched it at the last minute.
Do you think that's something we may be getting in 2012?
Yeah.
I mean, we've got the Olympics. We're being told there could be a terrorist attack there.
Yeah, Yep, we've got to be absolutely super alert. And just as what happened with the London bombings, we immediately started to analyse it and started to look at the holes in the story. What they've got to remember, anybody who's thinking of carrying out some kind of false flag attack on British soil, we will be all over it. We promise you. You won't get away with it.
Well, as I said before, we heard the music there. One of the people that died last year is a guy called Ted Gunderson. Mark was talking about the FBI having a campaign against pop stars. He was the head of the FBI in Los Angeles, and he retired about 20 years ago, and he spent much of his time tracking down and talking to and attempting anyway to get prosecutions against people who were conducting ritual abuse. And he decided that in fact this was actually much more widespread in the United States than people were actually prepared to admit to. And here is one of his colleagues who herself, her two children were involved in ritual abuse, Linda Wiegand, and then she refers to Ted Gunderson in this piece. This is from, I'll give you the information about the film that it's from afterwards. It's pretty harrowing stuff, I'll tell you that.
The devil to me, maybe 10 years ago, was something that was... I went to church and the devil was something out there that you didn't want to talk about at night, and you know, you didn't talk about in the dark, and it was just something in science fiction movies. My children disclosed just sexual abuse in early 1993. The behavior got worse and worse and worse. I don't usually talk about this stuff. I woke up one morning to the bread, you know, the butcher block that you cut bread on, because I'm a vegetarian, so it wasn't a butcher block. And there was a huge bread knife in the middle of the butcher block with a big pool of ketchup in the middle of it. And that was on my kitchen table. And I said to my children, what is this? Who did this? What does this mean? And my son John said, Mom, this is some of the things that we have to see and that have been done to us. I knew I had a big, big problem, and I had no idea what it was called. I called all over the country. I had children's drawings for the police. My husband was under arrest, and I had all kinds of drawings that had circles and people with, there was black candles always in the middle of these tables. And I went to the Catholic Church, and I said, I don't know what this is, but it seems to me these drawings are significant. There are all kinds of symbols I don't understand, and devil heads and goat's heads, and I had no idea what satanic ritual abuse was. Church asked me if I ever had a psychiatric exam. I said, actually, I'm completely sane. I just know that there's symbols in these pictures. No one would help me. Even though there was a prosecution going on, they said, if you ever bring up satanic ritual abuse, your credibility is lost and you'll just be a kook and it doesn't exist and it's not organized in America. Just focus on child sexual abuse. So I took my children to a child sexual abuse hospital. And while they were being treated, and I had legal custody of my children, they confiscated my house, everything I've ever owned, from my baby pictures to my clothes. I walked away with literally the clothes we had on our backs. Took my cars, my federal post office box mail, my income, my assets. I lost everything by taking my children to an expert on child abuse. It was trying to stop me from what my children could disclose from being uncovered, to try and just break that we had no assets to have my children have medical attention. The children being treated for sexual abuse, and I had provided all the documentation. And one day, the doctor said to me, I need you to come into my office. She said, this is a classic case of SRA. I had no idea. I mean, SRA, is that like a Irish, I don't know what SRA is. She said, satanic ritual abuse. And she showed me the drawings that the children were doing in her office. And they were of blood sacrifice, of people cutting their arms and dripping blood in chalices, of chalices with devil heads, and on and on and on. Because I'm only one person and my life has been annihilated, although I have to say it's being rebuilt for the better. But John and Ben, my boys, are 11 and 8 and have lived for 15 or 16 months in the home of a satanic abuser who has been documented as a member of a cult, who 25 people and the state's attorney in Connecticut are investigating and have substantiated sexual abuse and the cult. And yet the governor and no one has been acting to protect my children. So it makes me wonder just how high this goes. I need each one of you to know this is not a fairy tale. This is not something out of science fiction. I was a mom who ran a charity and baked oatmeal cookies for my kids. And because my children are victims, I have to stand here and I have to tell you these horrible stories. And I could tell them all day and all night, because both Ted and I get letters and calls for people begging for help all over the country right now.
Well, that was a rather harrowing testimony of Linda Wiegand there, who's a colleague of Ted Gunderson, former head of the FBI in Los Angeles, who died last year. You might not have heard much about him, but he used to send me things from time to time. I got a handwritten note from him here. Certainly they seem to think that this ritual abuse was actually going on in the United States, and we're doing something about it. Before we finish, let's have a look at one of the weirder stories of this year and possibly of next year too. That's the Higgs boson. This is something which is rather peculiar. I don't know if either of you think that, because this was a news story, even though it hadn't actually been discovered. The news story was the Higgs boson particle at CERN, the particle accelerator near Geneva, they might find it. And so what are your thoughts about this as a news story, and do you think there's anything massively important about this, Polly?
Well, I was totally perplexed by it. I kind of researched it, and, you know, on Wikipedia, and I listened to the news telling me what it was, and by the end I'd sort of forgotten it already. So something to do with the beginning of the Earth and God in a big machine, but I'm very
confused. The God particle. Yeah. Well, I don't know if it really exists. I think it's probably some sort of cover for a military technology experiment, but certainly bizarre. Anyway, that's all for this week. Coming up next is the Fresh Blood Party. I'm Tony Gosling, and thanks to our guests, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and political economist Polly Winch. We'll be back next week.